speak will be less than 30% of what he normally speaks.
That's some, I don't know, was there a survey?
That's some deep stuff, man.
Yeah, but like, how do they know 30%?
Like, because the rest of it is just nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. We speak with society or within our friends, communities and stuff like that.
So are you saying, like, it's actually not bad to be quiet and just not say anything? Like, I want to find out, is there a line between when not to, like, be speaking and when to be talkative? Okay, is there a line?
There is a line. Like, for example, when someone speaks up for their rights, when someone is being oppressed, right, you have to speak up.
Yeah, or someone else's rights, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a hadith that says that if there's something wrong that's happening around you, this is the gist of it, you know? If there's something wrong that's happening around you, it's upon the person who has knowledge to apply his knowledge and speak about it, you know? That's
definitely.
Yeah.
That's exactly how it is.
Have you heard the saying that in the times of disrupt, be like the disruption?
Yeah.
Be like the child of a camel. What do you call a camel child?
Okay, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, so that no one can milk you and no one can ride you. Where does that fit in?
That,
right? So you're talking about oppression. You're saying if there's oppression, for example, you have to speak up. But, like, oppression is a kind of disruption, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
So should I not be like that and not say anything, you know? Like, avoid this side or that side?
But then we have the story of Hazrat Ibrahim and the little bird that came and he was bringing water to Hazrat Ibrahim as well.
What story?
Whereas they say that so there's a bird that was trying to take water to Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was asked that, why are you taking this water to Hazrat Ibrahim? Whereas you know that this little drop of water won't be able to stop the fire. When Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam, he was caught in the fire and the enemies had put him into the fire, right? There was this one bird that was bringing a little bit of water within its beak. And so it was asked that, why are you taking a few drops of water that won't even help the fire go down?
A
little bit.
There had to be a catapult to throw him in because they couldn't even get close to the fire. That was a massive fire.
Yeah. So it replied that, at least I am doing my duty that maybe that it can help the Prophet, peace be upon him, and I can answer Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the Day of Judgment that I did my part.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if we stand up for places like Palestine, like we have the Day of Quds, which is well known worldwide, like the Day of Quds, the Rally of Quds.
What is that?
Which is on the last Friday of Ramadan.
Yeah, what
on
do you
the
do?
Month
what
of
do
Ramadan,
do?
We have a rally and standing up for the oppressed of Palestine, the oppression that's going on there. Yeah, and so it was said by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that every person, every Muslim, should stand up on and have a rally on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Right,
and it comes back to
what our ambition there is, right, or our goal, we can say, is that we're standing up for Palestine, even though we can't go literally or physically and go and help them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least we're speaking out for the oppression so other people can know about the situation as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then on the Day of Judgment, when we're going back, like, we're all going to go back, man, one day, unfortunately, or fortunately, yeah? And we can at least answer back that at least we did stand up for the oppressed. We did speak out for them.
Yeah. At times, being silent is being with the oppressor. So far, that's all we've been mentioning, right? Like, we have to... but there has to be a time that not saying something is better, isn't it? What's that? You don't say something, you're quiet. Is there a place that you're supposed to be quiet?
There is, like, for example, there is when you see that your argument, right, is not reaching anywhere, right, and you should not go ahead with that argument. And just silence is the best result that you'll get.
Yeah, there's a narration that says, stop for the sake of arguing. That's called jadl.
Yeah.
In Arabic. Stop doing that, even if you're right. Because you know there's no point, you know, there's no conclusion, there's no result of whatever you're saying right now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's no use over there.
Because you're not going to get any results from it. Like, you're just arguing for the sake of argument, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, if you have a dogma or the other person has a dogma.
Yeah.
You know?
When is it wrong?
Oh, you know, that reminds me. Do you know the scholar who wrote Mafati?
Mafati al-Jana.
Who wrote that?
Yeah, Sheikh Abbas Qummi.
Yeah, Sheikh Abbas Qummi. Do you remember the story with his father?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that one.
That's insane. That's what I remember of Silence is Alright.
Yeah. Like, his father, he comes and he's in his room and he's writing a book. And his father says, like, why are you always writing these kind of books, right?
Yeah.
And he knows that it's his father, right? So he can't argue back, right? And he says that, here, you should write books like these, which are at least useful to people, right? And then Sheikh Abbas Qummi, he picks up the book. He's silent, right? He looks at the back. And he sees that it's his own, like, handwritten book.
Yeah.
And then, mashallah,
he doesn't say anything.
Yeah, he doesn't say anything.
I don't know if that's how the story goes, but what I heard was a bit different.
Okay. Let's hear your part as well. Then.
Yeah, my part is this, that once his father tells Sheikh Abbas that, listen, there's a scholar there in the mosque and he's giving lectures from this book, which is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, either he was there or he was at home, but like, he said, you should be like that person. Listen to that scholar. You might learn something.
Uh-huh.
And he said, please pray for me that, you know, I'm like that. That's somewhere, you know, why he'd probably be silent, because that what he did wasn't for his own. Remember what you just said? You said, like, if you, it's not boasting and it's not.
If it's not backbiting or boasting.
Yeah, you know. So he didn't boast himself, you know, something that he did, he kept it quiet, you know. That's actually beautiful.
Like, in history, we have a lot of examples like that. Like, for example, we look at the example of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
They say that, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that al-mu'minu gharrun kareem. It means that a mu'min is a person, a believer is a person, that he's so generous that he is often seen as being tricked, but he's not actually tricked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's so generous that he doesn't let people know. No, he's silent. He doesn't let people know. For example, three mates, we're standing, and one of us makes a joke about the other person, and
the other one stays silent.
Yeah, he realizes that they're talking about him, but he doesn't say anything, you know, to not embarrass them or something like that. That's just where, like silence is proper, right, you know?
At that point, no one will stay silent, though. And the example you gave was nice, yeah, but in today's society, everyone wants their own little piece of the cake and reply back.
Yeah.
There was another example of Imam Ali al-Islam, when he stayed at home for the first couple of years when the Khalifas 25? Came in.
You mean?
Yeah.
The first couple of 25 years?
Yeah, because he saw that it wasn't of any use at that time. And
why,
then after it? That, he came out.
But he wasn't silent.
About the importance of silence, like going out and into society and like speaking for his rights openly.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm saying. Like, he wasn't silent, wasn't he? Was he? He wrote letters to them. He actually spoke against what they did wrong and stuff like that. So 25 years, you're actually right. It was a kind of silence, wasn't it? Like, because he said I was patient, as if there's a thorn in my eye and a bone stuck in my throat, you know. He didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
He couldn't like call out loud. So this was this. Why was this? Because he didn't want disunity among the people, and actually there would be no religion left if he had risen against those people, you know. So that's exactly. That was for the betterment of the religion, right?
Betterment of the Muslim Ummah and society around him. Yeah, definitely. That's exactly. Reminds me of another example. I have a good friend here, right? He's in Qom as well. The Sayyid, right?
Yeah.
And this guy, proper nice, humble guy. So he's going around and is helping this really old man, lives like near us. And so he's like, from the bottom of his heart, this uncle comes up to him and is like, listen, yeah, kiddo, I need some help. Yeah, I need you to buy my groceries. My son's like, so and so. He had a mental problem originally, the old man did, But so my friend just, because I'm being kind, he went and helped him out. So he's going every day buying this guy, I don't know, his stuff for his house and his groceries separately. Whereas this old man didn't need it in reality. He had his sons and stuff who helped him out. But he just had that, like, what do you call it, schizo or something?
Schizophrenia.
So this guy, yeah, he gets the stuff from him one day and he says, listen, I need my visa extended. He gives him his passport. And because he's in doubt of everyone, he comes outside his house and he knocks on his door. And he's like, where are you? I'm calling you. The guy was asleep and he was knocked out.
I don't get it. Whom did he give the passport?
He gave the passport to my friend, right? And
oh, the old man was Iranian.
The old man, he wasn't Iranian, right? He gave his passport to my friend and he said, help me out with my visa and stuff. So this guy comes outside the door and he starts swearing. He starts swearing his head off, right?
The old man.
And so my friend comes out and he gives him his passport and says, listen, man, I can't help you. End of story. Now, if he replied, right,
and
he would have got the same reaction back and forth and it would have carried on probably into fist fights and stuff. But because he was quiet and silent at the time, right, all the other people that lived in that area, and like now they know that this guy has got a bit of mental problems, you know.
Yeah, and this the other guy is respected
one,
now. Yeah.
It's like just one example of silence, right? How much has helped this guy?
We're talking about Imam Ali al-Islam and his patience. Have you heard the story about someone asking Imam why doesn't he think when he's asked a question?
Why doesn't he think?
Yeah. Why doesn't he pause or think
when
he's asked a question? And Imam says to him, how many fingers do you have? Go snap, five.
He says, then you didn't have to think.
Why did you not think about that? He's like, because it's obvious, isn't it? It's like so visible. I know that it's five. So Imam's like, everything that people ask me, like knowledge, is just like that for me. So that's why I don't think.
MashaAllah.
That actually indicates that when you do not know something, it's all right sometimes to be silent.
Yeah, I think we need to put that into practice.
But like, also, like, if you're thinking about the answer or whatever, you're silent. That's a different silence.
Exactly.
But you know, the silence or saying that I don't know is actually better than like making things up and just spilling them out.
Yeah, definitely. Like they say that one word after thinking and silence is better than 1,000 words without thinking.
Yeah,
exactly. May Allah give us the tawfiq to like act upon this, inshallah, because in society and
I'm gonna start practicing that right now. That's why you see me a bit down.
Alright, you can start it after the show, but I think within society it's not implied as much,
right? I think we talked a lot when it comes to silence, you know. Silence is something that's not supposed to be talked about, right? Like it's
something that's supposed to be acted upon.
Yeah,
right?
It's silence, but we talked a lot about that. Thank you for being here, man. From IRIB English Radio, with me was Hamza. We were talking about
silence.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and make me strong.
In the limelight. It's unlikely that Joe Biden will ever reverse Pompeo's stigmatization of anti-Israel BDS campaign upon assuming office. He's more likely to support the Zionist regime and its illegal settlements in the West Bank. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading U.S. Republican-Democrat Assault on BDS Campaign is Systematic. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the State Department will consider the anti-Zionist BDS campaign anti-Semitic and withdraw U.S. government support from organizations engaged in such hateful BDS conduct, calling the boycott, divestment and sanctions push a cancer and vowing to stand with like-minded nations on the issue. Pompeo stood beside the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he also directed the State Department's envoy on combating anti-Semitism to identify organizations that engage in or otherwise support the global BDS campaign. The BDS movement promotes boycotts and sanctions against the Zionist regime through various avenues. The aim is to end the Zionist regime's occupation of East Al-Quds, Gaza, and the Golan Heights, achieve equal rights for Palestinians, and return Palestinian refugees to the Holy Land. The designation of BDS as anti-Semitic is intended to silence the Zionist regime's critics, making supporters of Palestinian rights wary of engaging in public debate. It also seeks to make any debate even more fraught, with defenders of the Zionist regime policy emboldened to declare opponents who advocate any material pressure on Israel anti-Semitic. In the prevailing environment, don't expect Joe Biden to reverse the new policy. In addition to the clear statements made by Joe Biden and his pick for the post of State Secretary about their unconditional support for the Zionist regime and Washington's unimpeded military and financial aid to Tel Aviv during his term, Biden has never responded to Pompeo's policy, and it seems unlikely that he will. It's unlikely that Biden will ever reverse Pompeo's stigmatization of BDS upon assuming office. He is more likely to support the Zionist regime and its illegal settlements in the West Bank. This is because AIPAC is also behind Pompeo's attack on the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Both the American Republican and Democratic parties are critical to thwarting the anti-Israel BDS campaign. This will only make Biden silent on the matter, even though this goes against international law and their freedom of speech. This is why there are legal arguments for BDS by the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and many other groups that are all part of a global campaign to end the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestine. There is nothing illegitimate for this campaign or anti-Semitic about a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions in response to these crimes. Indeed, demanding or creating consequences for human rights violations or to create material pressure for changes in a policy that had caused so much bloodshed and misery for so long is lawful under international law. The new assault on the BDS movement is an assault on the fundamental norms of international law, and it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Those who claim that the Zionist regime should not be targeted with economic repercussions for its policies should defend that proposition on its merits. But any argument that boycotts against the Zionist regime are preemptively out of bounds is neither ethical nor credible. If the Zionist regime policies were justified, that argument should not be difficult to make without resorting to any effort to preempt the opposing viewpoint. Those who support the Zionist regime's illegal settlements are only prolonging the occupation of the regime in Palestine. Those that target the BDS movement only recognize the Zionist regime for the cancer that it is. Put simply, they are helping to recognize West Bank settlements as part of the occupied Palestine, even as most of the world views the move as a violation of international law. As mentioned earlier, the ongoing Republican-Democrat assault on BDS is a systematic assault on Palestine. It undermines international opposition to the Zionist regime occupation, colonization, and apartheid against Palestinians by calls for prolonging this regime on the one hand with anti-Palestinian racism on the other, in order to suppress advocacy of Palestinian rights. This fraudulent policy should be condemned by the international civil society, including world authorities on human rights at the United Nations. Despite the new shenanigans by foreign policy establishment in Washington, the BDS movement for Palestinian freedom, justice and equality is here to stay until all those struggling for a more dignified, just and free Palestine succeed in holding the Zionist regime to account and end its apartheid and settler colonialism.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, how to keep your faith strong.
In life, we all go through seasons. Some are wonderful, some are very rough. We go through mountaintop experiences and we go through deserts. Which are you in right now? Well, chances are your answer is based on your life experiences right now. Perhaps you just received a great new job, or perhaps you are without a job. Perhaps you're having a great season with your children, or perhaps they are being very challenging. Perhaps your marriage is in a great place, or perhaps you are struggling. The less your personal life experiences and situations impact your belief, the higher level of faith you possess. Many people, they claim, and in reality, they possess faith, but faith has different levels. When you are in your comfort zone, when everything is working out perfectly fine, you know, people tend to express their faith and use the quality of their faith in their decision making, the choices they make. But sometimes, contrary to this, if they're going through a rough patch, now the choices that they make, they're not necessarily based on their faith. And this is where many a times we all go wrong. When we're angry, for instance, do we take our faith into consideration and the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Prophet and Ahlul Bayt into consideration? Well, guess what? Most of the people who claim to be faithful, they don't. So make sure that your faith is not something which is changing because of your circumstances. If you want to possess a higher level of faith, be consistent. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing how to keep your faith strong. And we said that people, when they're faced with challenges and turmoils and trials, this is when their faith gets tried. So if you want to strengthen your faith, make sure that it's not situational. It needs to be this constant state of your existence, constant state of your heart, a constant state of your soul, which is to be in obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you attain that, and if I attain that, and if we attain that, rest assured that we have a higher level of faith. But let's say if our faith is trembling, it's all over the place, as soon as we get put into a challenging situation, we lose our faith and our decisions, they are contrary to what our faith dictates, this is something to be concerned about. Well, we all know the power of love. People give their lives for worldly love and material infatuations. Imagine if this love gets the right direction. It will do wonders. Look at our shuhada, the martyrs, our urafa, the mystics, how they have sacrificed everything and anything that they have for who? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because they have found their true love. So one of the tips today we're going to give you is fall in love with Allah. If you fall in love with Allah, you are certainly going to be able to strengthen your iman and faith. Obedience is the second one. When we obey the commands of Allah, He increases our faith in Him. Last but not the least is worship. Worship of Allah is a gateway to establishing that bond with Allah. He doesn't need our worship and ibadat. Okay, this is to our benefit. He strengthens our belief once we worship Him. So three things: love, obedience, and worship. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com. Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. As humans are experiencing record job losses and economic uncertainty, robots have become a hot commodity. Multiple technology manufacturers have reported increased demand for their bots over the course of the coronavirus pandemic, from drone-like machines that can roam hallways to make deliveries and artificial intelligence-powered customer service software to increased use of self-service checkouts at supermarkets. A recent report from the World Economic Forum predicted that by 2025, the next wave of automation, turbocharged by the pandemic, will disrupt 85 million jobs globally. New jobs will be created, but businesses, governments, and workers must plan to urgently work together to implement a new vision for the global workforce. The hospitality industry, which has been one of the hardest hit by the pandemic, has seen a clear uptick in the adoption of new technology during the pandemic. Hotels are allowing guests to use kiosks to check themselves in, apps to control the television and light switches in their room, and a few use delivery bots to send to guest rooms when they want a refreshment. We now present you an article written by Lauren Aratani. The piece is titled Robots on Rise as Americans Experience Record Job Losses Amid Pandemic. The article has been taken from a website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Lauren Aratani's article. They can check you in and deliver orange juice to your hotel room, answer your questions about a missing package, whip up sushi and pack up thousands of subscription boxes. And perhaps most importantly, they are completely immune to COVID-19. Whilst people have had a hard time in the coronavirus pandemic, robots are having a moment. The COVID-19 pandemic has left millions of Americans unemployed, disproportionately those in the service industries, where women and people of color make up the largest share of the labor force. In October, 11 million Americans were unemployed, compared with about 6 million who were without a job during the same time last year. And as humans are experiencing record job losses and economic uncertainty, robots have become a hot commodity. Multiple technology manufacturers have reported increased demand for their bots over the course of the pandemic, from drone-like machines that can roam hallways to make deliveries and artificial intelligence-powered customer service software to increase use of self-service checkouts at supermarkets. A recent report from the World Economic Forum predicted that by 2025, the next wave of automation, turbocharged by the pandemic, will disrupt 85 million jobs globally. New jobs will be created, but businesses, governments, and workers must plan to urgently work together to implement a new vision for the global workforce. The hospitality industry in particular, which has been one of the hardest hit by the pandemic, has seen a clear uptick in the adoption of new technology during the pandemic. Hotels are allowing guests to use kiosks to check themselves in, apps to control the television and light switches in their room, and a few use delivery bots to send guests to guest rooms when they want a refreshment. Ron Swidler, Chief Information Officer of the Getty's Group, a hotel design and development consultancy firm, said more hotels are experimenting with new technology during the pandemic. Swidler leads the Hotel of Tomorrow, a consortium of hospitality leaders that was re-upped in the middle of the pandemic to think of ways to innovate the industry. The group came up with 5 big ideas on how the industry needs to change, and new technology, including robots, are a core part of the equation. Citing Alibaba's FlyZoo hotel that is staffed nearly entirely by technology, from check-in to room service, Ron Swidler said, "The cost of automation is coming down, the technology is getting better, and we are seeing innovation working effectively in other parts of the world that we can transfer here." While the idea of being serviced by a BB-8 lookalike in a hotel may seem strange, Swidler said permanent job losses in the industry will be a reality as hotels adopt new technologies to try to save on labor costs. It is unclear whether the increased demand for new technology has directly caused job losses during the pandemic, but a discussion paper published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia in September found that automatable jobs, occupations that could be replaced by technology that is in development or is already available, lost 4.2 more jobs per every 100 than occupations that are less at risk of automation. According to the paper, occupations that are considered automatable include hotel desk clerks, shuttle drivers, and retail salespeople. The paper's authors raised a widely shared concern that the automation undertaken during the pandemic will be a permanent replacement for jobs. Lei Ding, senior economic advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and co-author of the paper, said, "The longer time it takes to fully control the virus, the higher the probability that the labor-saving technology will become permanent." Adding, "Job losses will become permanent losses." Currently, there are only anecdotal examples of permanent job loss due to an uptick in automation brought on by the pandemic. But the layoffs of hundreds of Pennsylvania toll booth workers provides one clear example of how labor-saving technology can sweep away jobs. In June, the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission laid off about 500 toll collectors in the state when it switched to an all-electronic toll collecting. For years, the commission had talked about replacing toll booth workers with automated collectors, and they finally gave workers a timeline. Per a union agreement, workers were supposed to be kept on payroll until at least October of 2021, with final layoffs happening by January of 2022. When the pandemic arrived, collectors were sent home in March, and were promised that the commission would still uphold the October 2021 date. But in June, the commission permanently laid off all of the workers over a year before the agreed date. Jock Rowe, principal officer for Teamsters Local 77, the union representing 300 of the laid-off toll workers, said, "We understand the safety of employees is the most important thing, but for them to have safety mean the elimination of their jobs. It's been devastating." Jock Rowe cited other toll collecting agencies that brought back toll workers with enhanced safety measures, including the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. The impact of a recession on the growth of automation has been well documented by economists and has shown that automation does not grow steadily, but rather happens in bursts. Businesses are more likely to automate after experiencing economic shocks, when they have strong incentives to save on labor costs. For a study published in 2016, researchers from the University of Rochester in New York combed through 87 million job postings online from before and after the Great Recession. They found that employers in cities that were hit hardest by the recession were replacing workers with labor-saving technology and more skilled workers. A report published by the Century Foundation found that the robot intensity increased in 2009 in the immediate wake of the Great Recession, particularly in the manufacturing industry. While an increase in automation can be good for educated workers and help to stimulate the economy, studies have also shown that new technology tends to leave low-wage workers behind. Darren Acemoglu, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said, "Automation has been a major driver in the increase in inequality." Acemoglu co-authored a study published in May that showed automation creates a prosperity gap that benefits high-skilled workers at the sake of low-skilled workers. Low-wage workers are not only more susceptible to job losses and wage depression due to automation, but they also experience the most job losses due to shutdowns. Higher-wage workers are more likely to be able to work from home during the pandemic, while lower-wage workers, a disproportionate number of them are Black or Hispanic, were more susceptible to layoffs due to shutdown orders. Important caveat many roboticists will point out is that artificial intelligence or AI technology is not quite smart enough yet to cause mass waves of layoffs due to robots. New artificial intelligence technology can take a lot of money, a lot of time and resources to set up, something that many businesses do not have during the pandemic. Matt Bean, an assistant professor at the University of Santa Barbara's Technology Management Program, said, "You should definitely not worry about losing your job to an artificial intelligence-enabled robot right now. If you're going to lose your job to automation, it's going to be some proven, well-known automation that is more than 10 to 15 years old." Acemoglu said, "Artificial intelligence has tremendous potential for making humans more productive without replacing humans, if society takes a human-centric approach to technological advances. But without the political will to make sure those who do lose jobs are taken care of by training them for new jobs, for example, the impact of automation can be devastating, and a pandemic that has already hit those workers hardest could leave a lasting legacy of unemployment." Acemoglu said, "I'm not saying automation is terrible. What I'm saying is that it would be terrible if we put all the eggs in the automation basket." He added, "We have, to a large extent, done so over the last 30 years. The pandemic will just exacerbate that."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the World with Reporters.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on. A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi. In the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role
in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohamed Fazari, from Khartoum, Sweden, city of Omdurman.
p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases, ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticised for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalisation, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners